This is Robert Berry, director of the 20th Century UFO Bureau. I think that perhaps in all of my years of research and investigative procedures into the UFO phenomenon, what you are about to hear is probably the most unusual series of events that has happened to me in all of these years. I began my UFO research at a time that I was a journalist in the field of radio broadcasting and also affiliated with a newspaper in Buffalo, New York. It started for me in the year of 1957 and the month of November. That's when I began researching the UFO subject. And it is carried through to the present time, at which time it is now a full-time work. You know, over the years, there have been reports of attempts to silence certain individuals experiencing close encounters of the first and second kinds. It eventually branched out to UFO researcher and investigators. It was during the 1950s and 60s that the MIB incidents became quite prominent, and it usually involved three men investigating UFO cases relating to landings and the filming of UFOs. The Men in Black, they were called, without fail turned up shortly after a sighting, sometimes flashing Air Force credentials or, in a few instances, NORAD identification cards. Now, this did not imply that they were from a secret government agency involving themselves in the UFO mystery, but one thing always stood out. The Men in Black knew of the UFO cases and the persons involved before the witnesses reported their experiences to anyone. In too many cases, the witnesses would oft-times remain silent in the event the local news media learned of the incident. The men would show up and instruct the witnesses to say nothing, absolutely nothing, or they could get themselves into a lot of trouble. The threesome were usually dressed in dark business suits and traveled in black government-type cars. There was an unusual case near Damon, Texas, that involved two deputy sheriffs. Earlier in the day, one of them was bitten by his pet alligator, sustaining an open wound on his arm. The twosome were now on duty, and while touring assigned areas in their patrol car, they sighted a UFO up ahead and near the road. They attempted to move in nearer. The injured arm of the one deputy was resting on the edge of the car window. Without warning, the UFO approached them, passed over the car, and bathed the injured arm with a light source emanating from the craft. By the time the deputies arrived in town, the wound was, listen, completely healed. It had been a pretty bad bite, but now it was as though nothing had happened to that arm. Arriving at a local restaurant with his buddy, the deputy with the previously injured arm was approached by a stranger and was told the following, quote, "You know, if I were you, I wouldn't say anything about that thing you saw on the highway." The stranger, as common as any earthman could be, turned around and departed. Now, up to that point, neither deputy had said anything to anyone. Another type silencer also surfaced. It was military. Now, these mystery men were usually dressed in Air Force uniforms or they flashed impressive credentials from various government agencies. Colonel George Freeman, Air Force spokesman at the Pentagon at that time, said that these men in Air Force uniforms would silence witnesses who had sighted UFOs. Colonel Freeman confirmed that they had checked a number of these incidents and concluded the men were not associated with the United States Air Force in any way, shape, or form, and therefore they were imposters. A New Jersey incident involved a man in Air Force uniform who investigated a UFO case in that state, and he warned the witnesses not to discuss their sighting and that they really hadn't seen anything after all. Well, a check was made at the local Air Force base in that locale, and confirmation was received that nobody from that base had visited the witnesses on the date in question. Another mystery man, bearing credentials from the North American Air Defense Command, now that's NORAD, came to the home of Rex Heflin, who had taken several excellent pictures of the UFO near a highway in the state of California. And this man demanded the originals. Later, NORAD denied having anything to do with that incident. the original pictures were never returned, and the Air Force was unable to determine the identity of the mystery man, reportedly from NORAD. It was during the early 1970s that I was interviewed by a lady news reporter for a Philadelphia television station. In private conversation, she related an incident that happened to her as a reporter for a Lancaster, Pennsylvania news outlet. It was late at night when she learned of a UFO that had landed in a small borough near Lancaster. Taking camera, paper, and pencil, she went to her car and began the short trip to the town involved. As she approached her destination, she was greeted by a barricade and police that stopped all traffic from entering. Now, the next day, she decided to try to look into the matter, because by the time she returned to her home that night, it was around the midnight hour. Bright and early the following morning, and en route to the UFO landing site, the reporter discovered the barricade was gone. And upon arrival, local residents were questioned, and it soon became apparent that all was quiet on the town front. Nobody was saying nothing about a landed UFO. Well, the journalist finally hit pay dirt when she managed to secure information from a few isolated persons brave enough to come forth, though they would not permit the use of their names. A UFO did indeed land in town the previous night, and there were several minutes before departing when it vanished into the heavens. Now, these same residents told of a black government-type car arriving within an hour after the UFO departure, and three men in black converged on the town residents, instructing them to remain totally silent about what they had seen. All did, except a brave few. The next move was to go to the police agencies covering that portion of the county, and was amazed to find absolutely nothing on police records. She checked next with Lancaster Police to see if they might have any information on the case. Well, they didn't. Contact was made with other police units in and near the vicinity involved. Nothing, absolutely nothing, was forthcoming. The reporter had run into a blank wall of silence involving the Lancaster County, Pennsylvania UFO encounter. Well, this marked another in too many cases of mystery men and their attempts to silence too many witnesses involved in too many unusual UFO encounters. My own personal experience involving a series of strange incidents had its beginning in the year of 1977. It was Lancaster County once again, and the date was January the 21st, 1977, when I appeared as a guest on a news-oriented program during the noon hour on the Lancaster County television station. During that interview, I showed several UFO film slides, one of which was a fantastic picture of a circular-shaped craft hovering at treetop level in the state of Oregon during the year of 1964. It was filmed by Dr. Daniel W. Fry, who at one time was affiliated in rocket research for the government at White Sands Proving Grounds in New Mexico. Many features stood out sharp and clear on that brilliantly white craft, which included a rim section and a protrusion at the top and the bottom center. The interview was very well received by the viewers, especially one. Later the same year, I was invited to appear again. The date was August the 19th, 1977. And prior to going on, I learned of a most unusual incident. The hostess of the telecast told me that shortly after I left the studios on January the 21st, she received a telephone call from a man who identified himself as being with the U.S. government agency and likewise gave his name. He was very upset over the showing of the Oregon UFO filmed by Dr. Fry and requested a videotape copy of that interview. It so happened, since it was a live appearance that day, they didn't videotape the session. Now, he was quite outraged to think that it wasn't copied on videotape, and he disgustedly hung up. That was on August the 19th, 1977, when I was told of this incident, and it was also the last time that I was to appear on that noon hour telecast. I was never invited again. Coincidental? Perhaps. But there's more. One of the oft-asked questions I received at various lectures on the UFO subject that I've given in the past was this question. Has anyone within government circles ever attempted to silence you because of some of the information that you have on crashed UFOs? Well, until the year of 1977, the answer to that question was no. However, during the summer of 1977, that answer changed as a result of a series of incidents that occurred to me. Now, on the 30th of March, 1977, a Western Union mailgram was sent to the 20th Century UFO Bureau, of which I am its director. It was dispatched by a film corporation in the Western United States. They were seeking information on the UFO subject for a major motion picture to be based on fact, but it was going to be dramatized by professional actors. The data desired centered on three areas. Number one, government contact with UFOs. Number two, government withholding of evidence on UFO existence. And number three, information on UFO crashes and the withholding of that information by the government from the public. Now, it was the latter category that I would be able to supply them the desired material needed for such a film. And as a result, I made contact with them. And as a result of that, was flown to one of their major offices, at which time I presented my material. Now, my material involved a crashed UFO in the state of New Mexico during the year of 1962. An outline of the complete incident was prepared and submitted for their consideration. Out of the more than 100 mailgrams sent to UFO organizations and researchers by this film corporation, only three were selected, of which our bureau was one of them. Many facets of the case were listed, including the tracking of the UFO and military radar scopes in the southwestern United States, an intercept mission undertaken, the performance of the spacecraft, which indicated flight difficulty, and the crash of that vehicle some 80 miles south of Holloman Air Force Base. The size and the basic description of the craft was also given, along with the discovery of two alien cadavers inside that craft. I also related where the bodies were eventually taken for scientific study of their body structure and what happened to the space vehicle once it was removed from the crash site. The submitted material was accepted, and within 2 weeks, a contract was sent to me by the corporation for the use of the 1962 case and other related UFO data in their movie, which was to be the main portion of the picture. I was to be a technical consultant to the nonfiction film, and the planned release to theaters across the country was late November or early December 1977. Now remember this, it's important. Oddly enough, and at the same time I was involved with the film corporation in the Western United States, I was contacted by a second motion picture company headquartered in New York City. Now, what was unusual about this was they, too, were working on the same type of a non-fiction film, crashed UFOs and the suppression of the information by the government. Their film was scheduled for release during the summer of 1978. Now, one of their advertising slogans, now that's the second motion picture firm, for their feature-length film on crashed UFOs was the following, quote, "The true story of the best-kept secret of our time." Now we have two motion picture corporations working on the same type of picture at the same time. After receiving my contract from the film company in the Western United States, I had reason to make contact with the gentleman that I would be working with in the production. I placed a person-to-person call to him and was informed that he was not there and wouldn't be for another day or two. He was in Washington, D.C., on business for the corporation. The contract was mailed to me on June the 17th, 1977. By the time I received the contract and reviewed it and made my call to him, it was around June the 20th, or perhaps a little later. I was at this point just a few days away from receiving a letter with the heading which read, Central Intelligence Agency, Washington, D.C. Dated the 30th of June, 1977, I was informed that recent reports received from CIA field representatives indicated I had received information that I shouldn't have. The letter in part said the following, quote, "A check of your file in the Domestic Collection Division's UFO Records Center does not indicate you were ever cleared to receive crypto material. The CIA letter indicated that they were aware of the two motion picture companies in the process of producing a film on crashed UFOs and government suppression. I was told the following. Neither of these companies is receiving cooperation on their respective projects from this agency. End of quote. Now, this would seem to indicate that the cooperation of the Central Intelligence Agency would be required if said film companies were to release such a film on this particular phase of the UFO subject. Not only that, but I was further informed the Director of Central Intelligence is totally opposed to disclosure about UFOs at the present time, and that the data on the crashed UFO case of 1962 is not releasable to the public until further certain conditions are brought about by presidential announcements. End of quote. Then came the hair raiser. The letter stipulated that since I had received unauthorized information, the director hereby requests your presence at CIA headquarters, Langley, Virginia, at 9 a.m. on the 8th of July, 1977. I was now scheduled for a debriefing session on the crashed UFO information and as a result would be placed under a CIA restriction not to disclose any of this information until I had received the proper legal clearance. Total silence on my part was requested as it relates to the CIA letter I had received, since the communication to me was considered a confidential matter between the director and yours truly. I was further told to make no telephone calls to the CIA or to any other parties regarding the matters discussed herein. This matter will not be discussed by phone. End of quote. The CIA letter was signed as follows. Quote, for the director, Arnold B. White, Chief of the Domestic Collection Division. End of quote. On July the 7th, 1977, the day before my scheduled meeting with the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, who at that time was Stanfield Turner, a second letter was received from someone using a code name. It said in part that the original letter had not been authorized by the CIA and that I was not to fear. Well, now it was time for action. I immediately called the Central Intelligence Agency and spoke with Elliot Rice of the Security Division and related all the data contained in both letters. Mr. Rice informed me that he would look into the matter, and if I was scheduled to appear the following day, he would immediately get back to me by phone. That was the last I ever heard of him. Before our conversation ended, he told me the information would be turned over to others within the Security Division, and perhaps I would hear directly from them, and perhaps not. That was on July the 7th, 1977. Nearly 1 year later, on the 17th of April, 1978, I sent a letter to the CIA requesting their findings of the investigation into the original CIA letter. After some time had passed, I finally received a correspondence informing me what I already knew, that such a letter was not the action of the CIA, and if I ever received another such letter, contact them immediately. Well, what for? It certainly didn't do me any good to contact them the first time. They denied having anything to do with it. But there's more. In the meantime, there's a question. Was the CIA letter a complete hoax and sent by someone not affiliated with, at least at that time, with any intelligence branch of the United States government? Or was it a scare tactic to keep the crashed UFO data from being used by the motion picture firm? There's more. In a letter to me and dated July the 18th, 1977, from the law firm representing the film corporation in the western United States that I was working with on the crashed UFO film, I was told to stop all my work on the assembly of UFO-related material. Now, one of the problems confronting me from the film firm was their request of naming my main information source, which I could not give them at that time for obvious reasons, since this man was still involved in government work. The attorney's letter also outlined the following. Furthermore, due in part to the difficulties the film company has encountered in obtaining the proper legal clearance, of UFO material of this nature, the organization has been unable to meet its original production and distribution schedule for a UFO picture and therefore has abandoned this project altogether. End of quote. I reflect back once again to the month of June 1977 when I attempted to contact the director of research development with the film firm to discuss some aspects of the contract offered me and was told that he was out of town. He was in Washington, D.C. You know, it's very interesting to bring out at this point that both film firms who were involved in the same type of production stopped their work on their films, and as a result, neither company completed their original undertaking of releasing a non-fiction motion picture film on crashed UFOs in the United States and the suppression of such cases by the government from the public. Interesting, isn't it? Well, with the release of the motion picture film entitled Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which was scheduled for December 1977, which had as its technical advisor Dr. J. Allen Hynek, formerly with the United States Air Force Project Blue Book Unit investigating UFO cases, is it possible that the government wanted to wait for the public reaction to such a film as this, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, before the release to theaters of a non-fiction picture on crashed UFOs? Well, it's food for thought. Now, reflecting back to the CIA letter and the statement that crashed UFO information is not releasable to the public until certain conditions are brought about by presidential announcements, another factor, an important factor, surfaces to make this cloak and dagger case all the more convincing. In the April 18, 1977 edition of U.S. News and World Report, an interesting comment was made in their Washington Whispers column, which said that the official word was coming on UFOs before the end of the year. Now, this official word was to have some unsettling disclosures on UFOs, and that such revelations, based on information from the CIA, would be a reversal of official policy that in the past has downgraded UFO incidents. End of quote. Now, this official announcement by the government, according to the article, could possibly come from the president. Now, you know, that is most interesting since my CIA letter did implicate the president and also the fact that, once again, the CIA is implicated within the framework of UFO information. Another interesting point to all of this is the fact that I received my greetings from the government in the form of a letter with the heading of Central Intelligence Agency, Washington, D.C. on it and dated June the 30th of 1977, which was a matter of slightly more than 10 weeks from the Washington Whispers column report in U.S. News and World Report magazine. Since the CIA letter states that I received unauthorized information, you know, it would seem to lend support to the fact that the 1962 UFO crash case in New Mexico is information the public should not be told, and most of all, let's keep it out of the movies. Interesting, since both film companies did just that, kept it out of the movies. And now, what about this Arnold B. White, who allegedly headed up the Domestic Collection Division of the Central Intelligence Agency? Does such a person in the division actually exist? Well, a personal friend of mine, also a UFO researcher investigator, was aware of my CIA letter. I had discussed it with him previously. Making contact with a gentleman formerly with the National Security Agency, my friend asked if he knew a, quote, Mr. White with the CIA. And that's as far as my friend got. The former NSA man interrupted by saying, oh, you mean Arnold White? He's head of the Domestic Collection Division of the CIA. End of quote. And not only that, but Arnold White was involved in the UFO phenomenon with the CIA as far back as 1967. Well, with that bit of information, I bring to a close this facet of the cloak and dagger game and move to the month of June and the year of 1978. We might call this the Dayton Incident. Well, the Dayton Incident occurred within the framework of the 9th Annual Mutual UFO Network Symposium during its two-day schedule of July the 29th and 30th of 1978. The location was the Dayton Convention Center, just a few miles from the famous Hangar 18 case at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Dayton, Ohio. MUFON had scheduled a number of speakers for the event, including one Leonard H. Stringfield of Cincinnati, Ohio. Mr. Stringfield was formerly affiliated with United States Air Force Intelligence and, in civilian life, a highly respected UFO researcher investigator since the early 1950s. His subject was Retrievals of the Third Kind, which was to be a case study of alleged UFO crashes and alien cadavers in the custody of the military. Little did he realize that while he would be speaking, a threat upon his life would be made. Mr. Stringfield is a personal friend of mine, and over a number of months, we indulged in numerous telephone conversations. Some of our discussions involved the category of crashed UFOs, and we mutually exchanged data. It was during the May-June 1978 time period that we went quite in-depth in our UFO discussions, one of which was the case of the CIA letter I had received the year before. Being quite interested in the overall situation of the letter, be it reality or a hoax, Len invited me to share a portion of his allotted time on the speaker's platform to relate the incident, since directly involved was the 1962 crashed UFO case in New Mexico. Len Stringfield and myself corresponded regularly between telephone and letters during June and early July 1978 in preparation for our presentation on the crashed UFO syndrome and the CIA letter. Because of the sensitivity of our subjects, I decided to make contact with one of my main sources, of whom I shall refer to as Mr. Q. This man was affiliated with the United States Air Force in the early 1950s and eventually became affiliated on a full-time basis with the Central Intelligence Agency. His investigations into the UFO phenomenon for the CIA over a number of years covered many aspects, including the crashed ones. During a telephone conversation with him, during the first week of July 1978, just a few weeks away from the Dayton Symposium, I was informed the intelligence unit was considering sending him to the symposium, but decided against it when a news release went nationwide relative to the topic categories of Mr. Stringfield and yours truly. As the discussion between intelligence and Mr. Q continued, they said nothing of the CIA letter that I had received, with the exception of confirming that they were aware of it. It seems it was Leonard Stringfield they were concerned about, and the reason involved the 22 abstracts that he would be presenting at the symposium on crashed UFO cases and humanoid bodies recovered. It seems that 80% of his information was accurate, and this was based on one-to-one contacts that Len previously had with those directly involved in retrieval operations of crashed spacecraft. On the 22nd of July, 1978, I was again in communication with Mr. Q relative to the upcoming UFO symposium in Dayton, Ohio. It was during this time that I was told both Len and I must proceed cautiously from this point on and stay with the data that we had planned to present and do not deviate from it. He suggested my wife Lucy and I should have a gun in our possession while in Dayton. Taken back by this, I sort of casually chuckled somewhat and told him that we didn't own a gun. He then suggested that we take a spray gun with us for our own protection. This would indicate something was known as a possible happening during the symposium, but he would not elaborate. He only cautioned us to be sure and have a spray gun in our possession at all times while we were in Dayton, Ohio, at that symposium.